expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 on February 22nd, 2004. Today we're talking about media ownership, the big fight in Congress that's been taking place over the past year and a half, and in Washington in general, and across the nation, over how much media should a single company be allowed to own, and what are the implications for our society of having concentrated media ownership. And we're very privileged today to have a guest to talk about this who has probably knows more about this than all but a handful of people in the country, who's been in the middle of the hurricane, in the eye of the hurricane in Washington, D.C., and just coincidentally, and fortunately for us, is also a graduate student, no less, here at the University of Illinois in the Institute of Communications Research, Ben Scott. Ben, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob.
Now, our more astute and observant listeners will quickly realize that Ben Scott was also the first producer for Media Matters for our first 6 months or year of operation. And I have to confess, in case of editorial integrity, that he's also my PhD student at the Institute of Communications Research. And finally, we should point out that the two of us together are co-editing a book called Our Unfree Press that is going to be coming out with New Press in May 2004. But I think you will quickly realize that Ben Scott is on this program not because of nepotism or cronyism at all, but instead because he has been working for the last almost year now, 7 or 8 months, on Capitol Hill, on media reform policy, and has a knowledge and a direct experience with these crucial issues that is, as I said, very few people in the entire nation have. So with that lengthy introduction, let's turn to Ben. And Ben, first of all, we're going to talk a lot about the media ownership rules that have been relaxed by the Federal Communications Commission and that Congress is now struggling with and possibly going to overturn what the SEC has done. It's been really one of the big issues that's taken place in Congress in the past couple of years, and really one of the biggest outbursts of public interest in a political issue in memory, according to members of Congress. But, you know, you went to Congress to work in the office of Representative Bernie Sanders in June of 2003, just as the media issue was hitting in Congress. Before we even talk about the media issue, maybe you could just say a few words about, you know, what you learned about how Congress works, how laws are made, how our government works. Because I've got a feeling that most our listeners, and I would put myself in this list too until recently, don't really know just how complex the process is and just how insulated it is from public opinion.
Well, that's absolutely true. And that's fundamental for every American citizen to realize that what they think they know about how the government works is probably farther from the truth than they could ever imagine. It's a sort of running joke on Capitol Hill for the folks that work there, whether they're members or staffers or lobbyists, that the big political game is something totally separate from electoral politics and indeed totally disconnected from the popular opinions of folks across the country and their political leanings on particular policy issues. I mean, the rules of the House and the Senate as constructed by our founding fathers in the 18th century and as they have developed over the years are extraordinarily complex and require not only a knowledge of the inner workings of the rules of the Congress, but also the ability to grasp the language of how to talk about it, how to participate in this big political game. I think the number one thing that people don't realize is how hard it is to pass a bill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, thousands of bills get introduced every year, and only a couple hundred of them pass. And of that couple hundred, only a few dozen deal with controversial issues of any kind, just because it's so difficult. It takes a long time, sometimes years, to pass a piece of legislation. It has numerous stops along the way where party politics intervene, and you have roadblocks and people trying to add different bits and pieces to that bill that change the nature of it. If you get a bill to Congress that bears any semblance to the bill that was introduced way back when, you've done well. And people mm-hmm. know that. And it's just a part of the game that everyone on Capitol Hill accepts, but which is largely unknown in the general public.
Now, one of the crucial roadblocks to sort of the will of the people being manifest in bills, as I understand it, is the role of the majority party and the power that the majority party leaders have over controlling what does and doesn't come up for a vote. And within that, the role of the committee chairs. And a lot of people don't understand just how central committees are to how legislation is drafted in Congress.
Oh, it's absolutely extraordinary and something that I knew nothing about before I got there. Now, the way the process works, you introduce a bill, and the bill gets introduced into the congressional record, and then it's referred to what's called a committee of jurisdiction. And in the House and the Senate, there's about a dozen committees that all preside over a handful of issues. You have the Judiciary Committee, you have the Energy and Commerce Committee, you have the Appropriations Committee, you have committees on transportation, on defense, on intelligence. And if the bill is referred, for example, to the Energy and Commerce Committee, as media policy bills are, if the chairman of that committee decides that this bill is not of interest to him, there's nothing you can do to get him to bring that bill up.
I mean, he's basically got absolute power.
He has total power.
So the people who elected that person in his district basically represent the whole country. I mean,
on that issue, absolutely. Absolutely. And the centrality of that figure means that everyone's currying favor with that person, including industry representatives, including lobby organizations of every interest group in the country that has investments in that set of policy issues. And most people will never even have heard of the members of Congress who preside over these committees. They're sort of the dark horses of power politics.
So the powers in the majority leaders of these committees and the majority leaders of the party in power, in this case, talking more concretely, the Republican Party now in Congress, which controls both sides, the House and Senate. The House is where you spent your time. And that means that all the committee chairs are Republicans, and they have absolute power, basically, over what can and can't be considered as a bill, even before it would come to a vote of the whole House, or then hopefully go on for a similar process in the Senate side and eventually get passed into law. Of all the body of work that the Congress does, what percentage of the American people, or the average person listening to this show, have any clue about consuming the news media? How much would they have any sense of what's taking place by their elected representatives on Capitol Hill?
I'd say less than 2%.
And is it the most important 2% they're hearing about? Would you say? I mean, what I'm trying to say, are they hearing about the stuff they should hear about, and the other stuff is not that important? How would you? What defines what they hear about?
I wish that were the case. I wish people were hearing in the news media about the most important issues on Capitol Hill, and I wish that they were being reported in an accurate way. But the reality is that most bills pass without notice. Reporters are looking for stories. They're looking for issues that have cachet, that have some kind of political controversy involved, that have a high-profile leader who's playing a direct role in the debate. They're not particularly interested in writing stories about a bill that suffered through the permutations of the congressional process and has been blitzed and remade and doctored in so many ways with such complicated rules that it's impossible even for the reporter to understand much happened, much less try to translate that into the language of the media system. So I would say the vast majority of legislation that gets through Congress and is signed into law is totally outside of the public purview.
We're talking to Ben Scott today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about Capitol Hill, Washington, D.C., and the fight over media ownership rules, which is taking place right now in Washington, one of the most important media policy issues in generations to take place in this nation, the debate going on. Ben Scott, our guest, is an aide in the office of Representative Bernie Sanders, has been active in this fight, has been central to it. We tape-recorded this show shortly before going on air because Ben wasn't going to be in town, so please don't call in today to sit back. Make a cup of tea, listen to the show, enjoy yourselves. Right now, we're just starting off by talking about some basics about how Congress works to give some context to understand how it's going to address this crucial issue of media policymaking. And Ben has been talking about basically how the will of the people doesn't really necessarily manifest itself in Congress, the importance of a handful of figures, the committee chairs, the party leaders, to really have their finger on the pulse and really control what does and does not get done, and how little the American people have any idea what goes on there, how it's really oblivious. And you like to tell the story about the Republican aide. Why don't you repeat that for our listeners that you've spoken with?
Sure. As a friend of mine who's essentially my counterpart in the office of a moderate Republican, and he was at my office a few minutes before a staff meeting that we were both attending. And we were talking about how it was that we both come to work in the Congress. And I asked him, speaking from my own experience, whether or not he had any idea how Congress actually worked before he took the job and whether his expectations were met or exceeded in any way. And he laughed, of course. And he said, no. He said, I had no idea. He said, you can't know. You can't know what's going on until you come here because it's just so complicated and so outrageous. He said, if the people of this country only knew how Congress actually operated, they would either be outraged or demoralized, and I'm not sure which one is worse.
You know, it's an iron law of democratic governance or of any sort of governance that the less popular awareness and involvement there is, the higher the likelihood of corruption, the higher the likelihood that powerful interests will be able to get their way against the interests of the majority of the population. And what you're describing here is the first half of that equation, very little popular involvement, popular awareness of what's going on, a lot of power that's not really accountable to the public or only in a very, very indirect manner is it accountable to the public. Does the second half of the equation follow? Is there corruption there? Are there moneyed interests then having undue power over policy?
I think undoubtedly, and I would go so far as to call it endemic corruption, that the money that sluices in and out of campaign funds, the money that is at stake in any given bill of significance, in particularly in energy or healthcare or defense, so those being the big political issues of the day, those folks and their lobbyist armies, which prowl the halls of Congress every day, are absolutely relentless and absolutely attentive to every single detail of the congressional process. They know everything there is to know about a member of Congress and how they might vote and their record on a particular issue and their alliance of political opportunities both in their home district and within their party. And they exploit them at every possible opportunity. And all of those skills are things that the public could not possibly participate in. It's a full-time job, and you have to have people paid millions of dollars to do it. Now, I mean, a good example of this is a very, very powerful member of Congress who's just announced his retirement, Representative Billy Tozen, who's from Louisiana, a Republican from Louisiana, who's been the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee.
He's especially pertinent, if I can interrupt, because his committee is the one that all media-related legislation goes through the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and he is that ranking cardinal, as they're called, who has complete control over what can and cannot be reviewed.
That's right. And he not only is he the power player in media ownership, he's the power player in pharmaceutical issues such as the reimportation of prescription drugs and the Medicare bill. He's a power player in energy legislation, whether we go fossil fuels or whether we go with alternative energy sources. Tozen announced his retirement, supposedly for health reasons, which I'm sure that's a factor in
the health of his bank account.
Yeah. The rumors have been abounding on Capitol Hill for months that he would retire, and it is now public knowledge that he's been offered two positions. Both by industries which he has been ostensibly regulating for many years. One, the Motion Picture Association of America offered him their top lobbying job in Washington, which is a $1 million a year kind of position. And the other position is the top lobbying guy for Pharma, which is the big pharmaceutical lobbying organization, which is also a $1 million engagement. So it really raises questions about, you know, what kind of work has this representative been doing if he is rewarded in the midst of his congressional term, which pays, you know, $150,000 a year, with a tenfold increase in salary.
You know, this is a good moment, Ben Scott, for us to basically, you came to Washington in June, and we were going to talk about this huge uproar, public involvement, and public uproar over media ownership that took place in the second half of 2003 in Congress and throughout 2003 in the country. But the context for how media policy had been debated in Congress for the last several decades had been really not one of much public involvement. And the world Billy Tozen had comfortably run from his perch as the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee over the past many years was one in which he really had no concern much about public outrage or public opposition to what he was doing, was it?
Well, that's sort of conventional wisdom in Washington that the more technical an issue becomes, the less you need to worry about it being an electoral factor, the less you need to worry about people becoming aware of it, about the news media reporting on it. You know, the Federal Communications Commission is a classic, what's called a kept agency, where you have five commissioners who have extraordinary power over the regulatory regimes that govern telecommunications, broadcasting.
I mean, they allocate the monopoly licenses to radio and TV broadcasters, which combined are worth in the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars.
That's right. And for decades, since the creation of the FCC back in the 30s, the industry lobbyists basically just camp out outside of the FCC, which is, you know, 10 blocks away from the Congress. And they file legal brief after legal brief and petition after petition, lobbying the FCC to decide their way on particular issues. And over the years, the FCC has really just become a referee between the different major industrial factions, whether you have, you know, the network broadcasters versus the regional broadcasters.
Now, as I understand it, Ben, in theory, the Congress is supposed to represent the public, though. The Congress's job is to go, because the FCC is created by Congress, the members are approved by Congress, the budget is set by Congress. This isn't like the Supreme Court, like they're supposed to be off on their own and not accountable. They're supposed to be directly accountable to Congress, which in theory is accountable to us. So theoretically, Billy Tozen and his House Energy and Commerce Committee, which supervises and oversees the SEC, and the parallel committee in the Senate, which is chaired by Senator John McCain of Arizona, they're supposed to be representing our interests to make sure these guys don't cave in to commercial interests. Is that right?
Well, that's, in theory, that's correct. The reality is that Congress is involved, but it's not the entire Congress. It's a handful of people in the relevant committees that really understand these issues. Just like the public at large, most members of Congress do not understand the details of telecommunications policy. It's very complicated. You have to study it very carefully. And even then, you may need a lawyer to interpret the language for you. Most members of Congress don't have time to do that. They may not even have a staffer who's assigned to that issue in particular. So what you have is a situation where a handful of members in the relevant committees oversee the FCC and their policy decisions. And do they represent the interests of the public? Very rarely. More often than not, what happens is that if there's an industrial fight over an FCC policy and the FCC goes with the broadcasters over the cable operators will go to Congress, to these cardinals, and say, hey, we're getting steamrolled over here by this commission. Why don't you do something about it? And the backers of the cable industry who have big cable companies in their district will make a phone call to the chairman of the SEC and say, what are you doing there? And the next time around, the bone will get thrown to the cable companies instead of the broadcasters.
So this is the dark world that we entered into in 2003 as the FCC came about to consider reviewing and relaxing its media ownership rules. Before we talk about that, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our guest today is Ben Scott, who has been working on Capitol Hill for the last 8 or 9 months, working actively on the media reform fight, on the media ownership question out of the office of Representative Bernie Sanders as an aide to Representative Sanders. And now we're going to spend the rest of this show talking about that fight. We are taping this show shortly before going on the air, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back and listen to what we're doing. Media ownership. Now, one of the crucial sets of rules that exist in the United States and have for a long time are limits on the number of these monopoly radio and TV licenses a single company can have. The government doesn't let one company own all the TV stations because there's only a limited number of stations and all the radio stations. It's considered in the public interest that there'd be more owners rather than few. That's a more democratic media environment. Likewise, traditionally, the government has prohibited companies that get these monopoly radio and TV licenses or cable system franchises from using their super profits they get from these monopolies from buying up all the other media in the community. So you won't have company towns and media. The theory, again, being that it's in the public interest there'd be diverse voices in a media culture. I mean, who could not agree with that? I mean, on the surface, that seems about as American as apple pie during the seventh inning stretch.
Well, I think you alluded to the reason why people don't agree with that in your summary of the situation, and that's super profits. You're talking about industries with cable and broadcasting where in the depths of the 2002-2003 recession, these companies are making 30-40% profit margins, which that is an unheard-of profit rate in any manufacturing sector. That's an unheard-of profit rate pretty much everywhere across the board unless you're in Silicon Valley in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have that kind of money at stake and you're working within the power structures of Washington, D.C., it really doesn't matter what the public thinks. If the public doesn't know about it, you can do whatever you want. And you know, the reality is, you know, it's not a direct transaction of bags of money for votes from members of Congress, but the system is constructed in such a way that members of Congress no longer represent the interests of the people. They represent the business interests in their district because those are the folks contributing to their campaigns. Those are the folks airing their ads on their television stations, on their radio stations.
And if there's no press coverage of the issues, the people are really pretty much oblivious to what sort of deals that go on, so they wouldn't even know about it.
You know, if you're a politician and all you're worried about is getting elected in 2 years or in 6 years, what do you care about this issue that the public doesn't know about?
And just to pursue this point further, I mean, you can imagine this coming fall in the congressional election in this district and in races across the state of Illinois, the hot issues will be debated. There will be two or three issues probably in every campaign. Gay marriage will be a big issue, no doubt, where a member stands in gay marriage. There might be issues of war and peace or certain issues about the economy, tax cuts, for example, or whether we invade another country along the way. But all these other issues that serving commercial interests that, you know, that could be of extraordinary importance for the environment and the media would basically sail right by. And really, no member of the public really know much of, at all about what these members of Congress actually do once they get back to Capitol Hill.
That's right. And they don't make any particular effort to let you know.
No, they don't seem to be jumping up and down to fill us in. Well, let's talk about media ownership then. We've got these longstanding rules which have limited the amount of company media that a single company can own. The big companies don't like it. They're chomping at the bit because there's so much more money you can make when you get to be bigger and bigger and you have less direct competition. In the fall of 2002, the Federal Communications Commission announced it was going to be reviewing crucial media ownership rules to see whether they should be kept in, around or not. What were some of these rules that the FCC decided to review?
Sure. I'll attempt to summarize them without getting too technical.
Yeah, definitely de-wonkify this.
I think the best way to think about it is...
Just the top two or three, the crucial ones.
The best way to think about it is in terms of the mediums that they affect. So... One rule is affects the network broadcasters. It affects how many stations across the country, for example, ABC, how many stations that broadcast the ABC television network can ABC actually own and operate? Mm-hmm. And how many do they have to, you know, simply affiliate with and have that station owned by somebody else?
Mm-hmm.
The more stations the network owns itself, the larger its market is to sell advertising on a national basis, and the more leverage it has about programming decisions, about the rates that the advertisements will draw. So the networks are very interested in having as many stations as they possibly can. The second rule to keep in mind is to do with local television. And this is how many television stations in one city can one company own? So if you have four or five television stations in one town, and one company owns three of them, their ability to control the employment market in the broadcast industry, the advertising market in the broadcast industry, particularly among local advertisers, is enormous.
There's a lot of money if you can do that.
There's a huge amount of money.
That.
It's the classic Econ 101, yeah. Economies of scale.
I mean, when these media companies are allowed to get bigger, it's not like they say, well, we looked at it and we decided to stay small. I mean, you either get big or someone's going to eat you.
Oh, that's right. And, you know, while the FCC was considering whether or not they would deregulate, these companies were, you know, drawing up the merger forms mm-hmm. so that the day after the ruling was made, they could submit them and the ink would barely be dry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're
mm-hmm.
ready to go. They've been ready to go since the Republicans came to power in 2000.
So national TV and local TV, and then what's the next biggie?
This is the big one. The big one to keep in mind, it's well known, it's called the cross-ownership rule. And what that means is, in 1975, the FCC ruled that one company should not be permitted to own a broadcast station, either radio or television, and a newspaper in the same city, because it would give them undue control over the local news market. That ban has stood right up until this year. FCC decided to rescind that ban and make it possible to cross-own media properties in one city, except for a small number of rural markets. So what that means, in a sense, is if you take these three rules together, one company in one city will be able to own three large television stations, the monopoly newspaper, eight radio stations, and the cable system. Not to mention the fact that these conglomerates that have that kind of purchasing power, they also own publishing empires. They own book publishers. They own magazine publishers. They do weekly magazines.
They have the billboard monopoly oftentimes in the case of a company like Clear Channel or Viacom.
Moreover, they have production studios. Mm-hmm. They are airing the content that they themselves have produced.
So by any account, if these sort of rules get relaxed or eliminated, either way, if the FCC gone either way, you're going, by all accounts, you're going to have more concentrated ownership, less competition, fewer voices, and a lot less localism in the media system.
Without a doubt. The ability of local people to have an impact on the programming that is delivered in their town or city, news and entertainment alike, will be dramatically reduced. I think it is almost indisputable, even by the supporters of this rule, that concentration will reduce diversity. The supporters of the rule argue that diversity doesn't matter anymore because you have the internet.
And so people can just go online and groove there.
They would like you to believe that going to Salon.com or MSNBC.com is exactly the same as turning on Dan Rather, that there's no difference between those two media sources.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, there are almost an infinite number of media sources. Therefore, it doesn't matter what the concentration levels are in broadcast and print. But the Consumers Union just put out a report just in the last few weeks where they demonstrate incontrovertibly that 60-70% of Americans get their news from, guess what, television and newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you add radio to that, you're up around 90-95%.
And the logic of these deals, if they were to go through, if these rule changes go through, is that instead of having 5 or 6 newsrooms, separate newsrooms covering this community, it's illogical if you own all the media to have 5 or 6 different newsrooms. You melt it down to one newsroom serving all your radio, TV stations, and newspapers. That's where the money is. That's what
right.
I do if I own the company. And any rational person would.
It's already happening. I mean, the prototype for that is down in Tampa, Florida, where Media General has the largest television station, the Monopoly newspaper, a handful of large radio stations.
Monopoly newspapers are redundant since we only have competitive newspapers in a few cities in the whole country.
That's a very good point. What the Tampa Tribune has done is they've built one building where all of their news personnel are housed, and the editorial desk is in the middle, and you have the radio on the bottom floor, and the television on the first floor, and the newspaper on the third floor, and the internet on the fourth floor, and they're all basically sharing stories. So you have one set of journalists who are writing the stories for the paper and the internet, appearing on the radio shows, and appearing on camera on the television news, and they think it's great.
You know, it's probably great for them, but the problem, of course, is that there's not a lot of competition to get stories. So if they miss a story for whatever reason, it's not going to get covered. And it doesn't matter how many websites you get in your computer, you're out of luck if you live in Tampa.
Well, not only that, they have not increased the number of journalists. So if you have to deliver the same story 4 times, that means you're covering one story a day instead of 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
So the number of stories gets decreased dramatically, and the workload for those reporters goes way up.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Ben Scott today on Media Matters. This is a pre-recorded show done just a few days before we went on air because Ben's going to be out of town. We're talking about the media ownership fight in Washington. We've given a very long introduction to this, and I think our listeners are beginning to sense that we're not big fans of media concentration. We won't keep you in suspense. We're not. Now, the FCC took up relaxing these crucial media ownership rules in the fall of 2002, and going with what we talked about at the beginning of the show, it looked like a slam dunk. It looked like it's going to sail through because the public doesn't know about it. It doesn't get any news coverage. The five-member FCC, 3 are Republicans who are firmly committed to getting rid of relaxing these rules. The Bush administration is firmly committed to getting rid of relaxing these rules. It looks like it's pretty much going to go through, and that's the way it's going to be, and we're going to have fewer media owners. What happened?
A remarkable confluence of forces came together to block that quick and easy pathway to deregulation. I mean, Commissioner Michael Copps, who's a well-respected bureaucrat in Washington, a Democratic commissioner, decided that this issue was way too important to be handled in the business-as-usual FCC style. And he took his show on the road, essentially, against the will of Chairman Michael
Copps. This is in the first half of 2003.
That's right. The first few months of 2003.
Michael Copps, during this process, for our astute listeners might remember, was a guest on this show just about a year ago exactly.
That's right. And Michael Copps made it his one-man mission to get the word out to the American people that the Federal Communications Commission, an agency in Washington that most people had never heard of, was about to do something that could affect their daily lives forever. Literally, if you make a decision like this and you deregulate the media system, there is no going back. The toothpaste is out of the tube. Once you allow these mergers, history tells us that Congress will never make these companies divest, and you have to wait until a new technology comes around and totally wipes the slate clean.
A meteorite hits the planet. I mean,
yeah.
We're at that level, basically.
So, I mean, he went around the country, you know, Paul Revere style, sounding the alarm to... Yeah. And every time he held a public hearing, hundreds of people, sometimes over 1,000, came out to tell him all about what they thought about the issue.
And how much support did he find among the American people for the idea of having fewer companies own more media?
Yeah, as he likes to tell it, 99.999% of the folks that he talked to in his tours around the country were against greater media consolidation. They were worried about the decline in localism. They were worried about the decline in diversity. And they wanted to have a say in the way the media system was constructed. And this is a remarkable moment in media policymaking, what Copps calls the awakening of the sleeping giant. What happened was all this political energy began to be channeled through civic organizations that were interested in democratizing the debate. Groups like Free Press, groups like Move On, and Common Cause, groups from the right like the Parents Television Council, even the National Rifle Association got involved. And before Michael Powell was able to call the vote in June on these media ownership rules, 750,000 people had contacted the FCC to say, don't do it.
750,000. And to give some sense of what a change that is, I think the standard for the FCC, that's biggest public input on any issue it had ever done before, it was, to my knowledge, 5,000
comments.
That's right.
I mean, $750,000 basically it just swamped their whole system.
It blew out their computer and phone system. The last couple of weeks they had literally blown out. They couldn't use their computers. They got so many emails.
So you would think that, and members of Congress responded by sending some letters to the chairman saying, you know, Mr. Powell, why don't you hold off for a few months and let's study this and be more a little more careful. And some members, such as my boss, Bernie Sanders, were calling for not only a reversal of this idea of deregulation, but also to take a closer look at the way the media system was constructed now. It's not like we're in the halcyon days of competition and diversity.
No, I mean, people were concerned, as I understood it, not because they thought things were great now and they're concerned about getting bad, but they don't think things are very good now and they see this is only making them worse.
That's exactly right.
Now, who were the sort of – why would people get off their duffs to do this? Who were some of the people, these 750,000 people in the first half of 2003 who were contacting the SEC and Congress to say, we don't like what the SEC is planning to do?
Well, they were citizens from all across the country, and they were really...
Was it just a bunch of liberals, the usual sort of bleeding heart crowd?
Not at all, not at all. And what William Safire called the Strange Bedfellows Coalition in a series of columns that he wrote in the New York Times about this issue, you had right and left, and not just, you know, moderate Republicans and the liberal left. You had far right and far left all together in the same boat.
In fact, you had the entire political spectrum, actually. I mean, there was the entire ideological spectrum was really united on this. You had no... There was no ideological position that was in favor of having fewer media owners. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say. And to some extent, that coalition has been represented in Congress despite the money machine that was pushing them to ignore the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And when Powell passed the regulations anyway, in spite of all this public outcry.
The deregulations or the relaxation of the rules.
That's right. Everyone expected it to blow over. I mean, that's the sort of cardinal rule of Congress is public opinion and the pressure that people can bring to bear on their policymakers is never more than a blip on the radar. They'll be hot and bothered for a few weeks, and then when the policy gets complicated or the process drags out, people lose interest in it.
So on June 2nd, 2003, the FCC votes 3-2 along party lines to relax these media ownership rules dramatically to allow the biggest companies to get much bigger, despite 99.9% of the 750,000 people who contacted them said they don't like this idea. They think it's a bad idea. And the public is, by all accounts, completely opposed to this. I mean, it's a slam dunk. And it normally looks like that's it. That's the end of the deal, and it's just going to blow over. Now, is the reason it didn't blow over because there's so much press coverage of this issue that it's the front page story that the evening news is suddenly covering this?
Hardly. Hardly. In fact, the American Journalism Review did a study of the press coverage of the media ownership debate in the run-up to that June 2nd decision. They did that in late 2003. And that report is absolutely scathing. The broadcasters...
Who stand to benefit
by stand to benefit
relaxation
tens of millions of dollars by this relaxation.
Billions, let's be.
They essentially just blackballed the story. They covered it only in the last days before the decision when members of Congress essentially forced them to cover it by putting up a stink in Washington where beat reporters for the major papers are obliged to report the issues of interest to the major parties. It was not a story in the as a grassroots issue. It was only a story when it came when the grassroots pressure showed up on the radar of the politicians.
We're talking to Ben Scott today on Media Matters. We're talking about the media ownership fight, the effort to relax the media ownership rules and the tremendous public uprising in 2003 through to the present time, 2004, to try to roll this back and stop the FCC's rule changes from going into effect so there'd be a more diverse ownership of media in the United States. This is a pre-recorded show. We did it a few days before airing, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back and relax. Enjoy the remaining 20 minutes or so of the program. So what happens? The FCC votes against the will of the public, 3-2 votes, split decision to relax these ownership rules to allow much more media concentration. As you said, normally Congress would simply would blow over, but didn't happen that way this time. What happened?
Didn't happen. You had a handful of members who decided that this was critical. This was mission critical for them in 2003, and they were going to make an issue of it come what may. And there were folks on the right and the left. There were.
Why are conservatives? I thought conservatives were for free enterprise and big business running everything. I mean, what would their concern be? And also, since some of these big companies are like Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation or Viacom, which owns Infinity Radio or Clear Channel Radio, feature rabidly pro-conservative politics in their news programming. Why aren't the NRA and the conservative groups like the Parents Television Council in favor of letting these conservative companies own more of the media?
Well, there are two reasons. The big one is localism. the conservatives oftentimes represent rural America. And in rural America, folks don't want their local television and radio stations to be owned and operated by large corporations headquartered in New York and Los Angeles who monitor a stable of media properties of which a television station in Lincoln, Nebraska is totally irrelevant to them. They're not going to care whether the quality of that station goes up or down. All they're going to care about is keeping it afloat, maximizing the ad dollars. The amount of the ability of those local programmers to preempt programming such as Super Bowl halftime shows from their values and taste of their local consumers will be totally impossible if the networks had total control over the stations.
Mm-hmm.
So localism is one big issue. Small business is another. If you have a competitor come to town in your small media market in a rural area with tens of millions of dollars to spend, what chance does a local entrepreneur have? What chance does innovation have against a company that's willing to take a heavy loss for 10 years before they turn a profit?
It has the world's greatest law firm in New York there to handle any law case.
That's right.
Out of the water.
And then there are those, and I think this is perhaps what drove the NRA to become involved, is their version of the localism argument is that for 30 years the Republicans have been arguing that the media companies have a liberal bias and they're out to get the Republicans. So why in the world would their own party be advocating for further consolidation of the media companies to give these bastions of liberal ideology more power over the political system in the American public sphere?
And one other issue that really attracted the right and the conservatives to this issue is obscenity, vulgarity, the rise of, you know, shows, these reality shows where people are like eating donkey crap and stuff and just doing stuff that's fairly gross up. Material, you know, and that seems to be driving a lot of this conservative concern about media ownership.
Without a doubt. And I think it's
not just conservatives. I mean, to be fair, this is a concern I think that, again, goes across the political spectrum, and it's not really something that's monopolized by those in the political right.
Well, I think particularly for a lot of members of Congress who are of the older generation, who've been around for 30 or 40 years, they remember the day when the television networks were considered as a guest in your living room. You sat down and turned on your TV, and Ed Sullivan was your invited guest, and you expected him to behave as such. You expected your television to fit in with the values of your home. And now that television is a money machine, and it's all about advertisers, and it's driven to target a particular demographic, that fit has broken down. And the indecency and the vulgarity that drive people to distraction really strikes a chord with conservative politicians who really feel like the media system has let down the public interest, which was it is designed to serve.
And how is that a media ownership issue?
Well, at the moment, there's a big debate about how to handle indecency. And one theory is that you fine the broadcasters ever greater amounts of money for pushing the envelope. The other theory is that the only way that treating it with fines and treating it with wrist slaps is really just treating the symptoms rather than the cause. And the only way to really produce alternative content, to really produce independent, local programming is to diversify the ownership structure. Because as long as you have an oligopoly market where the companies involved are really competing to one-up one another and to win the most expensive ad contracts, they're going to do the same kind of content over and over, and they're going to push whatever limits you set up for them. If you set up a competitive system, well, there are all kinds of alternatives, and everybody's offering new and different things, and people are shopping around and getting a breadth of in their media experience, the problem will resolve itself through a market system solution, which is an attractive prospect for conservatives.
Especially because I think the key thing here is the local owners again. That if in Lincoln, Nebraska, the owners of the TV stations and the radio stations are more likely than not to live in Lincoln or in Nebraska, they might be less likely to show something that would be vulgar knowing they live in that community. But if they live in San Antonio, Texas, or Los Angeles, or New York, or they're some huge shareholder living in another country, they really couldn't care less what happens in Lincoln, Nebraska, as long as they make their money.
That's right. If you're going to walk around in the grocery store and go to church with the folks who are watching your TV channel, you're going to feel responsible for them. You're going to be responsible for what you do.
So this is what fueled the right, and the liberals and the left were fueled to some extent by the concern about coverage of the war in Iraq and what was seen as really a pro-war news coverage that didn't really do justice to issues involved leading up to entry of the war. And I know this is what moved MoveOn.org to make them become an active player in mobilizing its membership to oppose relaxation of media ownership rules. How does media ownership affect things like coverage of the war in Iraq?
Well, I mean, the war in Iraq was really a bellwether for folks. That woke people up on the left to the reality that this long-standing idea that the media was liberal in its ideology was a hoax, because the war coverage for a lot of people looked like cheerleading. It looked like aggressive nationalism. It wasn't fair and balanced. It wasn't even-handed. It wasn't even factual in a lot of cases. And millions of Americans turned to the BBC to get their news about national interests. And that galled people. It made them realize, made them look around and say, where would I go if I really needed to know the truth? And now that I'm totally suspicious of the media companies that are on offer. And they realized they didn't have that many options. In this technological wonderland that we're in, you're reduced to a set of options that are largely determined by a handful of corporations.
And then the media ownership rules, if they did get relaxed, as the SEC would like to do so, it would mean that the leading media companies like Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation would even get to be bigger. And that scared the bejesus out of a lot of people.
Not only bigger, but more beholden to the politicians who did them that favor.
That's right, more beholden to those politicians. So it comes to Congress. This is a long introduction to get us now to Capitol Hill. Once the FCC votes to relax the rules in June of 2003, before they can go into effect, Congress has a chance to weigh in, because they have a certain period of grace period they have to go through. The Congress has a chance to review them and act on them if they want. Traditionally, they would sail right through, but this time a speed bump came up in Congress. And we don't have a lot of time, but maybe just quickly sort of explain in the summer and into the fall what the environment was like in Congress concerning media ownership.
I think you can start by saying that, yeah. A lot of members of Congress said, we've heard more from our constituents on media ownership than any other issue on the table except the war in Iraq.
Which is a quite extraordinary statement, considering there's almost no press coverage.
That's unbelievable. And it's really down to people getting involved in online media activism.
The internet really played a crucial role.
The internet played a huge role, not only in educating people about what was going on, but activating them at key moments. So every time we had a bill introduced that had a chance of reversing the FCC's rule changes, we had 10,000, 20,000, 50,000 people call in on the afternoon before the vote.
Now, telephone calls. Why not just have them send emails in or write letters?
Well, that was the real innovation of the media ownership campaign and the e-activists. So historically, the way you reach your member of Congress is you write them a letter or you send them an email. But email now comes in such large quantities, people and are technologically able just to divert it into a single box, and they get a number about how many people emailed them about the topic, but it doesn't really register.
But it's so easy to do multiple emails now. It's irrelevant.
That's right.
Someone can send 3 million emails.
You never know who it's coming from.
Yeah.
It's not a very – it's not, in their minds, a legitimate source of concern. Standard letter writing has now been delayed because of the anthrax crisis. All mail that comes to the Congress is delayed by about a month. So everything that you send to them, your member is going to be seen well after the fact of your interest. Phone calls, on the other hand, register an immediate impact.
Mm-hmm.
Every congressional office, at least on the House side, has 6 phone lines. So if 150 people try to call you in an hour, that essentially means that all 6 phone lines are going to be ringing constantly for 60 minutes. And that means 6 of your 8 permanent staffers are going to be on the phone constantly talking to constituents.
Now, does this happen a lot in Congress? I mean, members of the House deluge daily with lots of phone calls on a wide range of issues from their constituents?
It's never happened. Moreover, most members of Congress are accustomed to less than a dozen calls per day on all issues combined.
That's standard.
That's standard. And of that dozen, you know, 3 or 4 of those people are folks who call every single day.
Mm-hmm.
So getting 150 calls in an hour or 300 calls in a day on an issue
from constituents
in your district, that's a bolt of lightning coming down and striking your chair.
And it's just unprecedented on any issue.
On any issue. It's never happened before.
And this is what happened with media ownership in the summer and fall of 2003.
It would have been a remarkable moment had it only happened once, had it only happened in support of a particular bill. But that's the big story here is the sustained interest and the consistent pressure that the public was able to put on their representatives for 6 months and ongoing even to today. So every time the political leaders who opposed efforts to reverse the FCC tried to put up roadblocks, which in the past have distracted people and made them less interested, you know, if a legislative battle drags on for 6 months and goes into really difficult and complex rules of House and Senate operation, how long can people possibly stay interested, particularly if the media aren't even reporting on it?
Yeah.
And time and time again, the members of these internet organizations, they defied that wisdom. They defied that logic.
Here we're talking about the groups you've already mentioned, especially MoveOn.org, but also some of the conservative groups like the Parents Television Council.
That's right. Also, the unions were very involved. And
Consumers Union, Common Cause, a number of groups.
Really an incredible outpouring. And literally, I would credit this public movement with the passage of what is one of the most remarkable bills in the history of this Congress, which is the resolution of disapproval, which was passed by the Senate in September by a wide bipartisan margin. And this resolution is essentially a veto by the Congress of the agency ruling.
And it was a 55-40 vote in September after literally now millions of people have contacted senators on this, senators and members of the House saying they want to roll back the FCC changes in media ownership rules. The Senate, a Republican Senate, defying the leadership, the White House, which is strongly in favor of serving the media firms, defying the Republican leadership in the Senate, voted 55-40 to overturn the FCC in September of 2003. So this is democracy in action. It works. The system works, right?
That's right. Well, I mean, the fact that we're pointing to this one instance of a victorious democracy in action from the bottom up as remarkable and unprecedented is a disturbing comment about the way our government responds to the people. However, it is also...
Why is it disturbing? Isn't that good news?
Well,
it's
good news that we now are aware of this opportunity. It's bad news that for many, many, many years we have not taken advantage of it and the people have essentially been excluded. I mean, it is disastrous that most members of Congress are alarmed and surprised to hear from their constituents in large numbers on issues that impact.
Well, no, the Senate voted, though, 55-40 overturn all those rules changes and media rules in September. Now, have the rules been thrown out? I mean, did we win?
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, the Senate voting on that resolution of disapproval is step one. Actually, it's about step 30 in a process of 50 steps.
Okay. What else is up here? What do we have to do now?
The Senate passes that resolution, and then it comes to the House. The House would then need to pass the same resolution before it went to the White House. Unfortunately, the House leadership, particularly Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert of Illinois, has declined to allow a vote on that resolution.
Gee, why? Since, the overwhelming majority of the American people are for this, and why isn't he jumping up and down an opportunity to let the citizens have their way?
Well, he has no interest in the democratic process on this particular issue because the party policy is to support the business interests in the media industry. He has no problems siding with $100 million profits for big media corporations and siding against the vast majority of Americans.
Now, let's just say Mr. Hastert allowed this to vote, and the House voted, as the Senate did, to overturn the entirety of what the FCC had done. So they both passed the exact same piece of legislation. Then what happens to it? Does it go into law immediately?
Well, then the president would have to sign it, and he's vowed to veto it.
No. Well, then why doesn't Hastert let it go to vote and just let the president veto? Because then to overrule a veto, you'd need 2/3, which might be pretty tough to get.
It would be very tough. The reason why they don't want it to go to the president is because in an election year, the last thing you want is for your president to be vetoing a bill with wide bipartisan public support.
And how many vetoes has President Bush exercised?
Zero. He has never vetoed
anything.
So this
would be the first veto of his administration.
Right.
It would be something that 90% of the American people are in favor of.
It would be a political nightmare.
And that's why Hastert doesn't want to let it go to a vote.
Essentially.
I mean,
that and the millions of dollars the Republican National Committee stands to gain from the media companies.
So is it hopeless?
Not at all. And in fact, media ownership has enjoyed what is in reality a meteoric rise from obscurity to prominence on the public interest and public policy agenda. I mean, usually these kinds of issues, to get this much attention and to rile up this many people and get the attention of this many politicians, it would take years. It would take years to incubate that kind of political pressure, to take that kind of political ground, and to coordinate a coalition with the power to pass legislation against the grain of decades of policymaking, against the grain of the majority party, against the politics currently operating in Washington. And it almost happened in 6 months for media ownership. So if you step back a minute and you realize that the expectation to win is only realistic in the context of the remarkable, unprecedented progress of the issue, you realize that if media ownership was to be rolled back in 2 or 3 years' time, that would still be a remarkably quick victory, a remarkably fast response for the government to be acting on the public will.
So where do you think it's going to go? Now here it is February 2004. What's going to be the rest of this year? What are we looking at in terms of the media ownership fight in Washington?
Well, you've got this resolution of disapproval, which Hastert would like to keep off the books and prevent from coming to a vote to avoid embarrassing his president.
Can we force him to bring it to a vote?
You can. The way you force the speaker to bring this resolution to the floor is you introduce what's called a discharge petition. What that means is you pass around a letter to all the members of Congress, and if you gain a majority of their signatures saying we would like to vote on this measure, the Speaker of the House has no choice but to bring it for a vote. So there's currently an effort underway to build support for the resolution of disapproval in the House of Representatives to document the support that it holds in the public by getting the representatives to stand up and be counted. And I anticipate there will be another huge public campaign to bring this issue to the attention of the legislators and demand that it be taken up and solved properly. And the recent scandals perpetrated by CBS have only put more fire under these firms.
Here you're referring to not showing the Move On Dad during the Super Bowl and instead showing the Janet Jackson breast.
That's right. Not only that, but also paying $1 million to interview Michael Jackson as a quote-unquote news interview and refusing to broadcast a program about former President Reagan because the GOP decided it was insufficiently flattering.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, here we are. We've only got a couple minutes left on the show, Ben Scott, today in Media Matters. Now, the June 2nd is long past now. It's been 8 months since then. Have these rules gone into effect yet? What's the story there?
They have not. And, in fact, in September, just before that resolution was passed by the Senate, some public interest lawyers at the Media Access Project representing the Prometheus Radio Project in Philadelphia took the case to court. And the court agreed that what the FCC was trying to do posed a grave danger to the public interest, and they put a stay on the implementation of the rules until it could undergo proper judicial review.
And that's going on right now?
That's going on right now.
When do they expect a decision there, do you think?
The decision is expected sometime this spring.
So there's not that much time left, is there?
Not a lot of time. If the courts rule in favor of the FCC and the rules are implemented, the chances of Congress being able to reverse these rules go way down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there's a big push, a big effort in Congress right now to establish a policy.
Now, what would you recommend to our listeners here on Media Matters and WILL AM 580? What should they do if they want to get up to speed on this issue, if they want to participate as citizens in this issue?
The easiest way to find out the bare bones facts about media reform and find out how to get involved is to go to mediareform.net. That's a one-stop shop for a variety of media issues. They have a very effective e-activist network that will allow you to be involved at every important moment of the policy debate. I would recommend that you go to moveon.org and sign on to their list. They are also remarkably informed.
And if you're conservative or you don't want to deal with MoveOn, you can always go to Parents Television Council, which is quite a conservative group. And so are you optimistic as we look into the future here?
I am. I think a major statement has been made to Washington politicians that the public will not be shut out of these debates any longer.
Ben Scott, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Media Matters, and good luck in the future. We'll have you back on with a victory, we hope, at some point.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, bye-bye.
AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny early, then becoming mostly cloudy, the high in the mid-40s with south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, a chance of light rain in the evening, then light rain likely after midnight, the low in the mid-30s with southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, light rain likely in the morning, then a chance of light rain in the afternoon, the high in the lower 40s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour in the morning, shifting to the west in the afternoon. You're listening to WILL Urbana, public radio for Central Illinois. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.